chapter 27, verse 1. And David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines, and Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in any coast of Israel. So shall I escape out of his hand. It's a really sad place that our hero here, David, has come to, and he is despairing of life. I don't know if you've ever been there, but that's definitely where David is at this point. And he's been running for a long time. He's exhausted. He's trusted God. He's done well. I would say he's run a really good race. And little does he know, and often that's the truth, right? When we're in the midst of a trial, we have no idea that right around the corner is the finish line. We don't have access to that information. We can easily be critical of David because we've read the story. Look at David, chapter 29, bud, hang in there. He has no idea, and he is absolutely exhausted. He's discouraged. He's probably a little discouraged with God, and he says, you know what? Here's the deal. I can't do this forever. I've kind of caught Saul with his cookie, with his hand in the cookie jar, and I've made some statements, but it's just a matter of time, guys. Let's be honest. It's just a matter of time where he's going to come up behind me and catch me, and I'm a dead man, and I can't do it anymore. I'm leaving the country. I know this is my home. I know God has a plan for me. I thought anyway, but I'm over it. Quite frankly, I'm over it, and I'm just going to run. And I'm going to run so far away, Saul even won't care to follow me. Saul even will realize when he finds out where I am, there's that. That's over with. I don't need to pursue him anymore. He's left. He's now aligned himself with Gentile territory. He's no longer a threat to me and my kingdom. He no longer would even have respect among the Jewish people, having lived among the Philistines. So you have to understand, guys, we can read this, and we're a little bit Western. We're a lot of bit Western in our perspective. But David is sabotaging his credibility even in a lot of ways from a Jewish thinker, okay? Because he's living among the dirty uncircumcised. He could never be viewed as pure or called by God again. That is the way many would view this, okay? So David is throwing a lot away, again, from a Jewish perspective. Verse 2, David arose and he passed over with the 600 men that were with him unto Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the Carmelitess, Nabal's wife. You know, it's one thing to backslide, and I'm not at all feeding out any license to do that, but it's one thing for a Christian to get discouraged and get his eyes off the Lord and go to the world for support and whatever, to get perceived needs filled. It's one thing to do that. It's another thing entirely to do that as a leader, as an influential leader, which David was. David doesn't have the luxury of backsliding without dramatically affecting everybody that looks up to him. Do you see that? And David goes into this Philistine territory, but so do all 600 men, and so do all of their wives and children. There's a lot on our shoulders as leaders, whether you're a leader in this church, whether you're a dad, whether you are a business person with a crew. There's a lot that comes with leadership, isn't there? Most importantly, what comes with leadership is precious, impressionable souls. And I think that's important, guys. I think it's important as we make decisions as Christian people. Do we, and this is the Wednesday night crowd, you guys are the cream of the crop. You're the core of the church. I acknowledge that. Sunday morning is not enough for you. That's why you come back in the middle of the week, which is awesome. But are we matured spiritually to the point where we've come to a place where I don't make decisions solely based on me anymore? I can't. But my decisions are so entrenched in how is this going to reflect on my Lord and how is this going to reflect on the people that look to me. That is a classic and vital part of being a leader for Jesus Christ. Whether you're 12 or 92, you have to look at life that way. We don't have the luxury anymore to make decisions that solely affect us. Have you come to that place? Have you embraced that totally? I don't have the luxury to make decisions that only affect me. And I would suggest that even factors into liberties, doesn't it? Liberties even are dramatically affected based on eyes on. And I think that's a loving thing. I think to embrace that is to embrace the love of Christ. And I'd ask us all to pray about that and wrestle with that with a little bit. David tragically leads hundreds of people out of the promise, hundreds of Jews out of the promised land to live, not to cross paths or to make a shortcut, to live for a year and a half among the uncircumcised in horrible, pagan, idolatrous, and debauched circumstances. What are the children in this group? What do they see among the uncircumcised? You guys know, right? You guys know how they lived their lives. It was pretty rough. What did they hear at night when the sun went down over there in the Philistine camp? Things they have never heard before in the promised land. And so there's an exposure here that's just pretty dramatic if you think about it. Okay? Well, there's that. So David runs into the Philistine territory and everybody with him. And it was told Saul, verse 4, that David was fled to Gath and he sought no more again for him. David's plan certainly worked. Saul said, well, that's that. He's out of the country. Good enough. And Saul never does pursue David again after this point. David said to Achish, now this is fascinating to me. He said to the king of that area, Achish, if I've now found grace in thine eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country that I may dwell there. For why should thy servant dwell in the royal city with thee? And Achish gave him Ziklag that day, wherefore Ziklag pertaineth unto the kings of Judah unto this day. And the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was a full year and 4 months. So, of course, that's 16 months total. That's interesting, isn't it? First of all, guys, Achish, that is the same king that wanted David out of his city immediately. You guys remember, this isn't the first time David has stood before Achish. David stood before Achish in Gath in the past, and his life was so at risk. You guys remember what he did, right? He feigned mad. He kind of, went into acting mode, and he let spit run down his face, and he started to scratch at the door, and he kind of, really apparently is a great actor. He is artsy-fartsy after all. David is a musician. And he convinced everybody he's just absolutely lost his marbles. And Achish says, get that madman out of my city immediately. And what's amazing to me, what kind of personality does David have? Let's think about that for just a moment. What kind of persuasive personality does David have? Do we see, even in his low, struggling state, do we see God's anointing on him? I believe that we do, because would you consider the challenge with me for a moment to move into a city where you killed their hometown warrior with a rock and a sling? You were on the top 40 charts. Your people were mocked by this man as he has slain 10,000s of your people. You've already tried to kind of hide out in that city before. You were busted and kicked out. But now he's come back to that exact same location and he's convinced the king, I'm different. I'm with you now. That is extremely challenging, you would agree. And all I'm trying to get us to realize is when the Spirit of God is involved, it is amazing the persuasive influence that person can have, for good or for bad. I've seen a lot of people that I believe the Spirit of God was poured out on their lives and everything was going good in their ministry until it wasn't. Until it wasn't. And then they influenced people in such a dark and evil and selfish way. It's something to think about. But I'm asking us to consider the type of personality that David had, beyond just his harp playing or even his skills on a battlefield. Hey, with that, can I just throw a little side note in? You know, to be a leader, let's go back to that, to be a leader in a church, to be a pastor in a church. I certainly think having the ability to teach the Word of God is important. But I also believe this. I believe there's pastors out there with a tremendous teaching ability, great Bible teachers, but absolute horrible social skills. And they got the personality of an ant. Do you know what I mean? And honestly, they don't make great pastors. They make great teachers. Maybe they would be better served or used in a Bible college, but their social skills are kind of lacking. You know, I grew up with some of those men in my life. You know, almost like you come around them and you're like instantly insecure and feeling inferior. You don't know to shake their hand or run. Great orators, but not shepherds. See, sheep feel comfortable around a shepherd, don't they? The sheep aren't scared of the shepherd. They're very comfortable around the shepherd. And boy, somewhere along the lines, someone told pastors it was a good idea to lead with intimidation and force. And boy, you really get a lot done if people fear you. How ridiculous is that, huh? How ridiculous is that? Show me the sinners in the New Testament that feared Jesus. Man, they absolutely felt loved in his presence. Sinners were drawn to him. Read it for yourself. The wolves were afraid of Jesus. The Pharisees were afraid of Jesus. They were intimidated by his words, but not the other way around. So personality is important, guys. I really do believe God calls men with personality that can be influential and kind and people that can, you know, you can trust and who can win trust. I think that's important. I don't know who I'm speaking to tonight, but maybe you sense the Lord has a call on your life. My suggestion is social skills is a skill to pursue and to sharpen for sure. I'll end you with this. To be a bishop, to be an elder, according to 1 Timothy chapter 3, that man must be given to hospitality. That's a requirement for leadership, given to it, addicted to making people feel comfortable, just to make it real practical. That's a big deal. Well, here you got David. Amazing to me that he was able to convince and to persuade and to win over a man that, for all intents and purposes, should hate David and should be seeking him and his life as zealously as Saul, if you think about it. And then the other thing, you know, David really wants to be in the country. Now, we can make some big deals about that, and I won't. It isn't that David preferred the country over the city, although he did grow up in the country. I'm sure he's more familiar with the country world, but he just doesn't want accountability, if we're honest. He wants to live in the country, so he's far removed from Achish, because actually David has a pretty dark and sinister hobby he's going to undertake here shortly. There's a lot of anger in David at this point. I don't know if that takes away from your hero. There's frustration. There's probably a lot of bitterness in David. And David is about to go on, and I know there's young people in the room, David's about to go on a killing spree, a 16-month killing spree with 600 men. And I'm suggesting to you, I don't see God ever instructing, guiding, or endorsing any of it, actually. This is a pretty dark season of David's life. He's mad. Verse 8, and David and his men went up and they invaded the Geshurites and the Gizrites and the Amalekites. Those nations were of old, the inhabitants of the land. As thou goest ashore, even unto the land of Egypt. And David smote the land and left neither man nor woman alive. He took away the sheep and the oxen, the donkeys and the camels, and the apparel, and returned and came to Achish. And Achish said, whither have you made, I'm going to read it more accurately, a raid today? Where have you been raiding today, David, is the idea. And David will respond, against the south of Judah, against the south of the Jerahmeelites, and against the south of the Kenites. And David saved neither man nor woman alive to bring tidings to Gath, saying, lest they should tell on us, saying, so did David and so will his manner be, all the while he dwells in the country of the Philistines. So David would go on these raids. He kind of assumes like a Robin Hood status, if you understand where I'm going with that. And he would go into these villages. They didn't have a chance with David and his military prowess and these 600 elites. And he would take all human life and kill. And then all of the loot, all of the wealth, all of the livestock, all of the apparel, he would amass that wealth to himself. And he would come and kind of pay tribute to Achish. He paid this guy off. They're kind of operating like hired mercenaries at this point. And there's a reason why David killed every mouth in these communities is because he couldn't afford one survivor to spill the beans and talk. Because every time he went to Achish and he says, so where you been today, David, as he's collecting camels and livestock and designer clothes, he's like, well, another one of the cities of the Jews. So he's lying to the Philistine king, suggesting, I've been killing my countrymen because they've betrayed me. And this Philistine king believes him. He really believes that he's going out raiding his own people. And he believes David has crossed the line, see, a point of no return. And the more he's done that, the more of an asset he is to him. So it's allowing David to dwell among the Philistine people, kind of earn and build trust with Achish. And I would also suggest to you, God has not commanded David to do any of this. That's the hard part. And David's a good man. David grew up, he's a family guy. Not only is he a family guy, the law of Moses governs his heart. He's certainly ignoring a lot of that, but I would just ask you guys to think about what were the nights like for David in this 16 months? Did he close his eyes at night? And I'm not trying to be dramatic, but did he close his eyes at night and see ladies, you know, pleading with him, please don't kill us, and dropping the sword? There's a lot going on here that I'm telling you was difficult. And I'm just going to throw this out there. I know a lot of us here in David's royal days, in when he's actually the king of Israel, I know there's a time when he's in his cedar palace and he looks out and it convicts David that he worships God in a tent, but he, as a poor man, is allowed to live in this beautiful cedar post and beam palace. And he's like, man, it doesn't seem right to worship God in a tent. I'm going to build the Lord a house. And you guys know God, through Nathan, kind of blows the whistle, says, David, you can't build me a house because there is blood on your hands. It's an interesting statement. And we conclude and we theorize that it simply means because David has been a man of war, that's what God was referring to. But could it be referring to chapter 27? I lean that way for whatever it's worth. Because all of the wars that he fought as king, God dictated, God commanded, God said go. But this is a season of his life. There's a lot of blood on David's hand, and it looms over him, I suggest, the rest of his ministry, the rest of his life. And then one more thing, and we're going to pick back up in chapter 29 next week. We won't get there this evening. But whatever is going on in David's life leads him up to a point, just so you know, where he is actually willing to fight against the Israeli people. And there's different takes on chapter 29. But just so you know, there is absolutely nothing in the language of chapter 29 that suggests that David is kind of presenting himself like a double agent, just kind of pretending. And I believe we see God rescuing David in his sovereignty, not allowing him to participate in that battle. But I think David was absolutely at a point where I'm going to fight with the Philistines against my own. I'm telling you, there's something scary and dark going on. God is faithful to bring this filth to the surface and deal with it by putting David through a series of very traumatic and difficult trials. God's faithful. But I don't think this is one of David's shining moments personally. There's a lot in the law of Moses that he's violating. You might know that he was prohibited by the law of Moses to align himself like he has with the Philistine people. He literally is calling Achish his master at this point. He's serving quite directly Achish. He's dwelling among the Philistine people. He's supposed to dwell in the promised land. There's a lot. There's a lot going on here that is contrary to the law of Moses. There you have all that. Okay? Chapter 28. So we're going to leave David alone for the rest of the night. We'll pick up with David next week. Let's pick up with Saul's camp at this point. Well, there's a couple more verses here. Let's plow through those. It came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for warfare to fight with Israel. And Achish said unto David, "Know thou assuredly that thou shalt go out with me to battle, thou and thy men." And David said to Achish, "Surely thou shalt know what thy servant can do." We'll study that more in depth because I'm going to bring this back up in chapter 29. You know what I'm capable of, Achish. Doesn't seem to be deceitful. He's literally saying, "I'm in. You know what I'm capable of. You've seen what me and my men can do. Count us in." Some would love to think that David was lying and he had ulterior motives, but there just isn't any language that suggests that, honestly. David said to Achish, "Surely thou shalt know what thy servant could do." And Achish said to David, "Therefore will I make thee keeper of mine head forever." Achish actually intends to make David some type of officer in this campaign. Now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, even in his own city. And Saul had put away those that had familiar spirits, the wizards, out of the land. Now this becomes kind of the point, the rest of this chapter. In the early reign of Saul, he did something good. Can you imagine? In the days leading up to Saul's reign, it was very common for Jewish people to contact the dead. Troubling, knowing that they're the people of God, and that was certainly something God prohibited. But they would. They would have these mediums in their culture, and they would go contact them. They would have seances, and they would request to be in communication with the dead. And of course, Christians and Bible thinkers, we see it as a very demonic activity, and I think for good reason. When Saul was given his role as king, that's one of the first things he said, no more of that in Israel. No more talking to the dead. And there were pretty serious repercussions if you were discovered doing that. So he is the one that ratified that law, and he is going to violate his own law in just a few verses. Okay? Saul faces these Philistines. Look what it says in verse 4. The Philistines gathered themselves together. They came and pitched in Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they pitched in Gilboa. And when Saul saw the host of the Philistines, he was afraid. His heart greatly trembled. And when Saul inquired of the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by prophets. Now, what's sad about this, guys, is Saul has been in this exact situation in the last, you know, several decades of his reign, no less than 10 times. No less than 10 times this king has been exactly in this predicament, looking out over a sea of Philistines, and there wasn't fear, actually. There was actually a significant amount of courage, and there was some great leadership, and there was victory after victory after victory on the battlefield. What makes this time different? That's what we really need to ask ourselves. What makes Saul look out over this battlefield and just be absolutely paralyzed in fear? I'll tell you what it is. It's called guilt. It's called he has allowed significant distance between him and God. He hasn't talked with God in a long time. He's got a murderous heart, which he knows God is certainly contrary to that. He's got secret sin, envy. He's not in the Word. He's not praying. He's completely out of communion and fellowship with God, which is fine. Hear me out. Which is fine outwardly until you face a significant trial. Now, all of that fraudulent spiritual behavior and all of that faking becomes fraudulent spiritual behavior. And it becomes obvious that we're faking. And he knows, man, I got no substance. I have no relationship with God. I have nothing to rely on. And here I am supposed to lead a charge on the battlefield. He's absolutely terrified because he literally realizes I am going to do this solely in my own strength. And I don't have what it takes. Boy, there's nothing like a trial to expose, you know, our lack of spirituality, church. Can I just say, you know, for the nation that we live in, with the blessings that we have and the prosperity all around us, this might be, the United States of America in our current condition, it might be one of the easiest places to be spiritually fake. You think about that? It might be one of the easiest places on earth. It might be one of the easiest places in church history to be spiritually fake. Because we're just kind of, you know, kept from a lot of trial and difficulty with the unbelievable blessings of our land. But I'm telling you, God will see to it, won't he? Because he loves us. God will see to it that his bride is put to some very necessary tests. God will see to it. I believe that his bride is pure and purified. And there's nothing like a trial like this, invasion or worse, to really get us to be tested at our core. Do I have a legitimate relationship with God? Because right now I need one more than ever. And I think that's what we're seeing here. What do you do in a situation? You know, Saul did what we would do. That he cried out to God. He inquired of God. And he tried all of the former ways he's always heard from God. He tries. God refuses to speak to Saul through dreams. He refuses to speak to Saul through the priesthood, which he ordained and called him to. He refuses to speak to Saul through the prophets. God has refused to speak to Saul in all of the ways God speaks to kings. Everywhere he goes, dead end. Why is that, guys? Because God hates Saul? Because Saul is living in a state of sin. He's living in a state of rebellion. I actually think it was one of David's Psalms where it says, if we regard iniquity in our heart, the Lord will not hear us. There is no communication with God if we regard iniquity in our heart. That's why I would plead with you tonight. If you are one of those Christians that think, man, I smoke some weed and I loosen up and then I can really read the Bible. I've heard it. I've heard it a lot. That might sound, I'm not even trying to create any humor. I'm telling you, there's a lot of people that I love that really have convinced themselves of that. They're uptight. They're stressed out. Just a little toke. And, I can calm down and then they're in the Word. But have we duped ourselves? Have we duped ourselves into thinking we hold on to these sins, right? Things that God says, don't do that. Do not be drunk with wine or intoxicated in any way, but be filled with my Spirit. God wants to lead us a different way. He wants to bring peace and rest to our lives a different way than through, you know, brain dysfunction. That's the world's way, guys, of resting and relaxing and calming down. That's the world's way of doing it. There's a better way, actually. You know, if your mind is stayed on the Lord, the Scripture says, and we trust in him, he will hold that individual, what do the Scriptures say? In perfect peace. It's an awesome verse. Man, I remember when I found that verse, I hung on to that one. Because one thing about me that you might not know is I am an extremely anxious person. I got a lot going on internally that I try to hide, but I got some issues, and I've always had those issues, and my mind is really loud. My mind is very busy, and I'm really thankful for a relationship with God because it's actually brought to my life for the first time in my life focus and clarity and purpose, something I can give my thoughts to. I've never found that meditating on the Scriptures, I can't exhaust the profound information in this book. And my mind needs something to fixate on and think and chew, and my mind needs that. And when I didn't have a relationship with God and I stewed on sin, horrible things came out of my life. That's the truth. So I have discovered peace, man, and it's no drama. I'm telling you, I have peace in my life. I can wake up with legitimate joy and purpose and an excitement to live because I trust in the Lord and my mind is stayed on Him. I've lived that verse. That's why I'm sharing it like that. I know it's true. I know it's effective. So if you've convinced yourself that you're going to hear from God better because you're a little buzzed, I think you have the whole counsel of God contrary to that thinking. And I say that lovingly to challenge you. Anyway, Saul is not finding God saying anything to him because of those reasons. Verse 7, then Saul said unto his servant, seek me a woman that has a familiar spirit, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And the servant said unto him, behold, there is a woman that has a familiar spirit at Endor. I personally think there's some time between those statements. I think they went out and combed the area, went into a few saloons and went into a few taverns and did some interviews and got some inside information and came back and reported to Saul, we found a lady. So what is a lady? Maybe you're new to the Bible and that's not familiar language. What is a woman with a familiar spirit? It's a medium, okay? My old English Bible is going to call her a witch. But the truth is, this is somebody who probably has demonic possession themselves and they're able to at least deceive people enough into thinking that they can contact the dead. I'm just going to throw this out there. I grew up in a little town, a little farming community, a beautiful farming community. The town was called Etna, Maine. Has anybody ever heard of Etna, Maine? You know what Etna was famous for? I mean, like back in the 40s and 50s, famous for? A little place called Camp Etna, where there were mediums that literally would help people contact the dead. And people from Hollywood, famous people, would come to Etna, Maine in the 50s when the trains would run. You know, this train ran right across my farm, right across the front lawn. It would shake the china in the hutch as the train would go by. But that place was on the national map because of that dark little group of people. Man, I grew up with that little weird group of people in white robes. And, you know, we'd be down the tracks, you know, me and my brothers, you know, after dark. And I don't know if any of you guys gone. Anybody know what a horn pout is? Yeah? Man, there's some good old people here. Well, you start a little fire, you know, and you'd catch horn pout all night long. And they'd come to the fire like moths to a porch light. And they're awesome food, by the way. It's if you ever find a horn pout, a catfish, but, you know, they got the horny, pouty face. And, man, those things would swallow a hook right to the tail. If you've caught them, you know. And, you know, I'm struggling with getting that thing out of there. My dad would, like, kid, what are you doing? My dad had an awesome way of instructing. He would kind of make you feel like, this is the last time I'm going to show you this. Pay attention. That's the way my dad taught, which I love it. He'd drive a stick all the way to the tail of that thing. He'd take the line and pinch the stick, and he'd spin that thing right off in a bucket. I'm like, my dad's a magician. I don't know how he does that stuff, but it was tremendous. But we would be out there catching these little fish, and all of a sudden you'd hear this bell ring at Camp Etna up on the ridge behind us, and the bell would go backwards. It wasn't like, bing, like it'd go, bong, bong. I mean, as kids, you're like, yeah. And then you'd see their little lanterns coming down to this big area where they would come down on the pond, and me and my brothers would be like, this is a little embarrassing. This is how rich we were growing up. We got on our lawn tractor, which pulled a trailer. We didn't have a four-wheeler. We had a lawn tractor with a little wooden trailer where we'd bring all our fishing gear in. We'd all jump on that thing, you know, we're speeding out of there before we get, I don't know, strung up and scunned by the crazy white-robed Camp Etna people. But that's always been in my mind a real dark thing, man, a real disturbing thing. And it still goes on today. This witch from Endor, I mean, there's people that embrace that in our life, in our country. This is what Saul, think about it, guys. This is what King Saul, the first king of Israel, This is what he, you know, resorts to get some comfort and counsel in a time of war. I don't know if we're going to get much further in our reading tonight, but man, what are the things that we've stooped to for counsel, advice, comfort in our time of stress? We look at this and think, man, how pathetic. Really? Is it any more pathetic than wanting to be comforted and we stoop to or resort to a nude image that gives us this little comfort? I mean, I counsel a lot of people, and that's what a lot of people say. I just stressed out and, you know, panicked, and they resort to porn for comfort. Like, for comfort? You know, or whatever, guys, whether it's a substance or, you know, we can read this stuff and we can think, man, it's so base, it's so vile, it's so less than what God intended. And I just want to say this, you, this evening, whoever you are, you were made in the image of God. You are so much more significant and precious and valuable than an animal. An animal runs to that instinctive base stuff. But we got a spiritual component, guys. We are so valuable to God. He came to this earth and shed his blood to redeem us and walk with us. That's how significant we are. And don't you know, man, when we're stressed and we're uncomfortable and we want, you know, consolation or what, he wants us to go to him, and it is so much more significant what he has for us than a little thrill from a nude image or a buzz or a fist fight and an adrenaline surge, whatever it is. Well, I'm telling you, what God has in mind for us as his children, it's awesome, guys. And look what people stoop to. It's dark and it's unnecessary is what I'm suggesting this evening. It's unnecessary. You know what you ought to do? You ought to read ahead. This gets really strange and disturbing, this chapter. I said we're going to get to chapter 29 next week. I don't know. But I'll throw this out there. This is actually one of the more difficult Bible passages, actually. What we're about to read is a lot of opinions. I'll shoot mine out there, but I'll make sure that I'm not dogmatic. There's a lot of good men that disagree with my position on this. But read ahead. Figure it out. Maybe show up with some questions, and we'll make this our business next week. How's that? Well, we'll pray. We got one more song we can leave with.